This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Democratic congressional candidate Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan says the tone of trade negotiations with other countries has been unhelpful.
We really do depend on our allies for trade, for diplomacy, for our place in the world. And I would like to see us working together without quite so much tension.
Londrigan also tells GLT's Mary Cullen she'll wait and see about new trade agreements with Canada and Mexico that analysts say look a lot like the old ones. Plus, Heartland Theater opens the classic Ibsen play, The Doll's House. Laura Kennedy has more. And Ryan Denham reports on the 88th District State House race between Joe Blair and Keith Sommer. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Voters are accustomed to politicians who love to self-promote, the ones who call press conferences to brag about all the bills they've introduced or give impassioned floor speeches ahead of a controversial vote. State Representative Keith Sommer isn't like that. GLT's Ryan Denham explores Sommer's two-decade tenure in Springfield and what his constituents think of his relatively low volume.
Sommer is one of the state's quietest lawmakers. The Morton Republican has introduced far fewer bills than other local lawmakers. He serves on only four committees, among the lowest for any House Republican, especially one who's been there since 1999. He hasn't updated his Facebook page in over 600 days. He's posted one press release to his official website this year about a bill he got passed requiring state education officials to post a handbook online to help kids with dyslexia. Sommer's quiet presence is now an issue in his race against Democratic challenger Jill Blair of Bloomington. She's his first general election opponent since 2008, first-time candidate trying to ride a blue wave to victory in a red district. Blair says she's been knocking on a lot of doors in Bloomington, and many voters don't even know Sommer is their state representative.
Number one, we're not going to get better results if we keep sending the same people to Springfield. I wanted to make sure that anybody who is holding elected office is working for it and is representing the people.
Sommer did not respond to requests for an interview for this story. His 88th House district includes much of Bloomington, stretching west to include Morton and Washington. The bulk of Sommer's support in past elections has come from the Tazewell County side of the district, where he's from. Earlier in the 72-year-old's career, he served on the Morton Village Board, then was Tazewell County's Recorder of Deeds, then joined the Tazewell County Board. Sommer is a good fit for the district, according to Dave Zimmerman, now the Republican chair of the Tazewell County Board. Zimmerman says the county has the second lowest tax rate in Illinois, and constituents there don't want to see the government spending money for anything but the basics.
I think he kind of takes that philosophy to Springfield that, you know what, let's do what we are supposed to do and do it really well. And, you know, if there's money left over at the end of the day, maybe we can look at some of these discretionary things. He's not a flashy guy, but we're not looking for flash. We're just looking for somebody that really represents us well and votes with our values in Tazewell County.
Zimmerman is one of several elected officials in Sommer's district who told me that he delivers when they need it. Washington Mayor Gary Menier says Sommer was instrumental years ago in getting the Illinois Department of Transportation's attention and sign-off for a major expansion of Route 8, as well as $250,000 in IDOT funding for an engineering study of a dangerous intersection of Nofsinger Road and U.S. 24. Menier says they've occasionally disagreed, but got past it. For example, the Washington City Council raised the minimum age to buy tobacco in the city to 21. Sommer voted against a similar bill in the House in May.
Keith, when he talks, you better listen because he doesn't talk a lot.
Sommer also doesn't pass a lot of bills. He's sponsored just 54 bills that have become law since 2009. Of those, he was chief sponsor of just 18. One of those was Sommer's 2015 bill to make pumpkin pie the official state pie of Illinois. Morton, after all, is one of the top pumpkin-producing areas of the country. Here's Sommer talking about the bill back in 2015.
Well, it's not just about the pie itself, though. It's about economic development. Our farmers rely upon it in central Illinois as a cash crop. In fact, it's a guaranteed crop.
Jill Blair, his Democratic opponent, says she's got nothing against pumpkins.
I think that's wonderful. You represent a place like Morton. I love pumpkin pie. We all love pumpkin pie. We just got done with the Pumpkin Fest last week. But after 20 years of representing the district, if that's what you're most known for, I'll leave that up to the voters to decide if that's what they want.
By contrast, fellow House Republican Dan Brady from Bloomington sponsored 186 bills that became law during that time, three times as many as Summer. Brady is also part of the House Republican leadership, unlike Summer, even though he's been in the House for two fewer years. State Representative Mike Eunice is an East Peoria Republican who joined the House in 2011. Since then, he's sponsored 165 bills that have become law, including 55 as chief sponsor. It's more than triple what Summer did. Morton Mayor Jeff Kaufman says he sees that low productivity as a good thing. Not a bad thing. He says voters there don't want a representative who goes to Springfield to pass a bunch of laws.
Keith Thumb is the kind of representative I like. He doesn't go to Springfield to pass more laws. He goes there to enforce the ones we got.
Kaufman says Summer is popular in Morton.
I don't think he's a grandstander that he has to be patted on the back for getting something done.
There's at least one legislative area where Summer has been active, adoption. Summer and his wife adopted two children from China. He introduced a bill in 2015 aimed at streamlining the international adoption process for Illinois families. It was signed into law. His vocal approach to that issue is noticeable in the State House, where Summer literally sits in the back row. That's according to State Representative Andre Tappetti, a Chicago Democrat who chairs the International Trade and Commerce Committee. That's one of the four committees on which Summer serves. By contrast, Brady sits on 10 committees, on 11. State Representative Tom Bennett, a Gibson City Republican who's only been there since 2015, is on six committees. Here's Representative Tappetti.
So he's the type that, you know, you don't hear from a lot. So when he does say something, you definitely kind of like, hey, wait, what's Keith Summer talking about?
Tappetti says that Summer is reasonable, but definitely a party guy. He says Summer, a real estate agent, was helpful in the committee's work on a bill to create the Illinois Trade Policy Task Force.
You can have a conversation with him. He won't, you know, blow you off. He'll hear you out. But at the end of the day, he's a party guy.
Summer is the top Republican on the International Trade and Commerce Committee. The McLean County Chamber of Commerce's Government and Public Affairs Manager, John Walsh, says that's a good fit for his trade-reliant district that includes a lot of farmland and Caterpillar. Summer was one of 33 House recipients of this year's Illinois Chamber of Commerce's Champions of Free Enterprise Award for his business-friendly voting record. That record includes opposition to a proposed increase in the minimum wage to $15 and his vote along with many Republicans against overriding Governor Rauner's budget and tax increase vetoes. Both of those happened in 2017. Here's John Walsh.
He's not necessarily at every single function that you see him as, but you know that he's working for the district.
Given their adjacent districts, which butt up against each other here in Bloomington Normal, it's hard not to compare Summer's tenure with Dan Brady's. While Summer has stayed under the radar, the ever-present Brady has emerged as an influential member of the House Republican Caucus. He's the top Republican on the Appropriations Higher Education Committee. He's one of the leading GOP voices on higher ed. Their voting records are similar but not identical. One example, they both voted against HB 40, which removed prohibitions against using public funds to pay for abortions and certain other provisions concerning abortion restrictions. But Brady broke with Republicans to support the Equal Rights Amendment when it passed the House in May. Keith Summer voted against it. That one bothered Jill Blair.
I think that was out of touch with what constituents want. It's historically been a struggle in Illinois, and we had a real opportunity to make a historic moment in Illinois by finally ratifying the Equal Rights Amendment, and my opponent voted against it. I know that he heard from constituents who wanted him to go the other way.
Blair is a former Heartland Community College administrator who also worked for Country Financial. She faces an uphill battle as she hopes to knock off the 10-term incumbent. She drew 6,700 Democratic primary voters in March. Summer drew 10,000 Republicans. Summer's slower fundraising pace might help keep Blair competitive. As of June 30th, Summer had about $31,000 in his campaign fund. Brady had six times that. Eunice had $750,000. He also moved money to other House Republicans more frequently. Since 1999, Summer's campaign fund has contributed $56,000 to other political organizations, including the House Republicans, McLean County Republicans, and others. During that same stretch, Brady's campaign contributed more than $400,000 to other political groups. Those records come from the State Board of Elections. Blair is trying to keep pace. She's received $16,000 since September 1st alone, and large contributions from several union political action committees. She actually nearly outraised Summer in the second quarter of 2018, though Summer still had double the campaign war chest available. It's common for an incumbent. Third quarter fundraising reports are due out Monday. The last time Summer faced a Democratic general election opponent was Tom Schreier in 2008. It's a slightly different district back then because of redistricting, but Summer won 70% of the vote. Schreier lives in East Peoria, still involved with the Tazewell County Democrats.
The people of Central Illinois do not seem to really want to move off of their party line. They vote Republican or they vote Democrat. It just seems like you, even if you're a better candidate, you can't get them to move. There seems to be more R's in that district than D's.
Schreier says it seems like there's a lot of Morton heavy hitters who want to keep the status quo, that Summer's job is to go to Springfield and not mess anything up.
As far as fixing the state or helping with any problems, it just seems like he just doesn't do much.
Summer and Blair will appear at a GLT League of Women Voters debate Wednesday, October 17th at Illinois State University's Alumni Center. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can find all our election stories and read candidate responses to our questions in the GLT Voter Guide. Find it at wglt.org/elections.
Support for GLT comes from the Central Illinois Regional Airport in Bloomington, now offering Frontier flights nonstop to Denver International and Orlando International Airports. Cirrus says, don't travel before you travel, fly local. Details and schedules at CIRA.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the Bloomington Fire Department dedicates a memorial to firefighters. With just under 5 weeks until the midterm election, Democratic candidate for Illinois' 13th District, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, rallied her base in Bloomington Normal recently before marching to the polls. Incumbent U.S. Representative Rodney Davis has held the seat since 2013, but a Cook political report in the summer moved the district from likely Republican to lean Republican, and now the race has received some national attention as Democrats work to win 23 seats they believe are necessary to flip control of the House. GLT's Mary Cullen caught up with Londrigan ahead of her rally in Bloomington.
You recently signed a letter with 106 other congressional candidates across the U.S. calling for significant reforms to reduce the role of money in politics, but money and politics go hand in hand. So how can you reduce the role?
Well, you know, I was endorsed by End Citizens United, and of course I want us to be able to get an amendment to overturn that and get some of that money out. In the meantime, though, there's steps that we can take right now. You know, we can shine a bright light on these political donations so that people have knowledge, right? So that they can see who is donating to some of these big super PACs. You know, for example, the one Paul Ryan's super PAC that just dumped $1 million in the race against us. People have the right to see who is funding this dark money.
So in a previous interview with GLT earlier this year, you said the tax bill passed late last year only benefits the top 1% and that you want to work to grow the economy from the middle class out. Can you explain how you plan to do that?
Sure. You know, let's talk about the tax bill that was passed. What I can tell you is that people within the 13th district in particular, and I have now put close to 60,000 miles in my car getting around the district and held 14 open free to the public town halls, one in each county. People are very aware that that tax scam and the benefits from it were not for them. That the people who benefited from that are the wealthiest among us, corporations, and that all the promises that were made around that did not come true. Of the, I think, 6 million corporations that benefited from that tax bill, 500 gave their employees one-time wage bonuses or wage increases. So all those benefits did not go to the middle class. And what I've said consistently is that any tax reform that I support has to be targeted at the middle class.
The GOP tax bill has caused a steep increase in the budget deficit, and the Congressional Budget Office actually reports the federal deficit jumped up 20% from last year in the first 10 months of fiscal year 2018. So how should Congress deal with that, since the tax law is a fact and it's on the ground?
Well, the tax law is a fact and on the ground right now, right? But that doesn't have to be so. And, you know, what scares me and what scares the people that I'm meeting with throughout the district is what comes next, because now they have added almost $2 trillion to the deficit. And what they're saying is that they want to be able to make, you know, we have to make cuts, and they want to go after what they call, meaning the GOP in Congress right now, refers to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid as entitlements, when these are, in fact, earned benefits. People have paid into Social Security. They have paid into Medicare their entire working lives. And to say now that you're going to change the rules at the end of the game is simply not fair. And so whatever we do next, what I can promise you is that I will not balance a budget on the backs of our elderly, our children. I won't do our sick. I won't do it.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with the Democratic candidate for Illinois District 13, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. At the end of September, a TV ad funded by House Speaker Paul Ryan's Super PAC aired, stating you would support a health care plan that could cost over $32 trillion. Since then, multiple cease and desist letters filed on your behalf ordered TV stations to pull the ad, insisting the ad was false. What was false about the ad?
It's categorically false. What they are referring to is Medicare for All, which is not something that I have supported. I have very specifically said on multiple occasions that what I support is first fixing the ACA, because the GOP in Congress has tried, they couldn't get it repealed, and our Congressman Rodney Davis tried real hard, and they couldn't do it, so they keep trying to chip away at it. And what that's done is that has caused, you know, premiums to go up, and we are at risk of losing some of these essential health benefits that people rely on. So I want to make sure that we fix the ACA, get it stabilized, and then the next step that I think really makes sense for the people in our district in particular is to offer a public option, and that would be the Medicare public option, and introduce some competition into markets in smaller rural communities and to small business owners.
So if not the $32 trillion for Medicare for All, how much would your proposed public option that would be competitive with private sector plans cost?
Well, I think that we have to look at that and how that's going to affect the 13th district and which exact areas we could start it in first before we talk about the numbers. I think it would be maybe 3% of that.
Like you said, we're not going to talk about specific numbers right now, but how would you suggest that government does pay for it when those numbers do come out?
Well, when you offer Medicare as a public option, it's not the same thing as people who, when they reach, you know, 62 or 65, that they are then eligible for it. What you're really trying to do is to offer competition into those markets.
So as far as I can tell, the ads have not yet been pulled. Now what?
We just try to correct the record. And, you know, I have put, like I said, I've put a lot of miles on my car. I am with voters around the district every day. And they hear me. They ask questions. And I have been very consistent on my message. And I just keep thinking that consistency and telling the truth is going to win over the lies that they are slinging at me.
So as a candidate whose health care stance has been a primary platform piece, how do you come back from an ad like this?
With the truth. I mean, the truth is on our side. And this is not the first time that that Congressman Davis's camp and supporters have lied about me and tossed mud my way. So, but we've got the truth on our side. And we're just going to keep speaking the truth and talking to people and doing what he refuses to do, which is to stand in public forums, listening to Democrats, Republicans, independents, anybody who shows up, because I personally think that that's the job, and that as a representative, you pay the respect to the people within your district who employ you.
So analysts of the new trade agreements with Mexico and Canada suggest that they're not that different from the pre-existing trade relationships. Is it no harm, no foul, or what's wrong with the result?
Well, I think right now we're going to be in a little bit of a wait-and-see mode on this to see how it plays out. Probably what worries me a little bit more right now is the tenor that we have with people who have been our allies for so long. And I want us to dial that back, and because these people have been with us and been by our side for so long. And we really do depend on our allies for trade, for diplomacy, for our place in the world. And I would like to see us working together without quite so much tension.
One of the reasons President Trump embarked on a trade war with China and other countries is a disproportionate negative impact of manufacturing from previous administrations' free trade stances. How can U.S. trade policy help manufacturing short of a trade war?
Well, now, in the beginning, what I think that he was trying to address was China dumping steel. And that did have to be addressed, and it could have been addressed in a legal way, because some of those cases get caught up in court for so long that by the time that they make it through, then it's already happened and it's too late. Where it went a bridge too far, even when you're talking about steel and aluminum, was in joining partners like Canada in it. That doesn't make any sense to pick a fight with our allies. So it kind of goes back to what we were talking about before. And then it went a big bridge too far with the tariffs, because here we are in central Illinois, in the heart of soybean country. And right now, Illinois stands to risk $4 billion worth of exports, $1 billion worth of soybean exports. That's the heart of the heartland.
That's Mary Cullen speaking with Democratic candidate for Illinois' 13th Congressional District, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
Support for GLT comes from Retrofit Culture, proud to support local and regional artisans by sharing their original clothing, jewelry, and home decor pieces with the Bloomington Normal community. Open Tuesday through Saturday at 1014 West Washington in Bloomington. More details at retrofitculture.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, students continue to protest against gun violence at schools in a workshop tomorrow in Bloomington Normal. John Norton will have more on that. Bloomington's Miller Park is a place to play, but also a place to remember the community's past, its war heroes, its railroad routes, even its history of segregation. This weekend, a new memorial will debut recognizing the Bloomington Fire Department. One of its main attractions will be a new bronze sculpture from noted artist Andrew Jumonville. GLT's Ryan Denham visited Jumonville shop to find out how he planned to create a historic sculpture that was also human.
Standing in the middle of Andrew Jumonville's shop is a towering man, regular height but on a pedestal, heroic. It's a sculpture, still in clay form, of a Bloomington firefighter. He's standing tall, surveying an unseen emergency that he's responding to. He's draped in the tools of the trade, heavy equipment, an oxygen tank, helmet, a New York hook for pulling and prying. Andrew's attention to detail on that stuff is amazing, but it's not the star.
When I look at something like this, all that stuff that's hanging on him, all that decoration and Baroque kind of a Rococo stuff that's on the crust, right? I'm not looking at that. You know, I'm seeing a guy in his underwear. and you know, what's the man underneath, right? And so getting that expression right is going to be everything. And the heroic nature of all the gear, I'm not looking at that. I'm looking at the humanistic qualities that are going on underneath all of that stuff, right? It's still a man doing this job.
Andrew's bronze sculpture will be unveiled Saturday at the dedication of the new Bloomington Fire Service Memorial at Miller Park, honoring 150 years of service to the community. I visited Andrew over the summer when he was still carving out the sculpture in his backyard shop in Founders Grove. A project like this takes hundreds of hours of work. It began with a real-life firefighter who struck a pose at a work session months ago, attended by Andrew and the committee that hired him for the project.
I got there with the actual firefighter, dressed him up, posed him in a number of kind of things, and it was sort of a, you know, here we are, we had a live doll, essentially, right? And sort of messing with him and sort of doing things, and it really is a collaboration.
After that modeling session, the real work begins.
Well, on day one, it's a couple of pieces of black pipe and some spray foam. I just make a big blob, essentially, sort of generally the idea. And then it's just a matter of carving into that foam to get the general mass of the piece.
Then Andrew covers it all in an oil-based clay, around 200 pounds of it. He precision carves that into the final shape with all the nooks and crannies of the final sculpture. A few weeks ago, he put the firefighter in the back of a box truck and drove him to a foundry in Indianapolis.
And just drive him over there in the middle of the night, most likely, because heat is my enemy. It won't melt, but it will be delicate.
The foundry is where they'll make a mold of it, then a wax of it, and then eventually get burned out, casted in bronze. That's what's being installed at Miller Park.
I have a skill set that allows me. I can do every stage of the production of this thing other than pouring the hot metal. You know, so I can weld it, and I can make the molds and the waxes and that sort of stuff. And I like to normally maintain that level of control because each one of those iterations of the piece is another point of manipulation of the surface, right? And so you can dress it and tool it, and there's a whole range of subtle kind of mark making that happens in each one of those phases.
This is hardly Andrew's first public sculpture in Bloomington Normal. He's worked all over the country, too. You've probably seen Andrew's work yourself. There's the Kickapoo Shaman at Lake Bloomington, and the well-known Convergence of Purpose sculpture featuring Abraham Lincoln, Jesse Fell, and David Davis outside the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Andrew attended Illinois State University. He actually trained as a painter, but he says painting can be a little bit too much of smoke and mirrors.
I like the tactile quality of it. I think that I was always interested in sculpture. The paintings that I used to do were dimensional sculptures. You know, they're kind of hybrids of this. I like the permanency of sculpture. It's going to be around, right? I like the public forum kind of quality to this. Paintings usually require, you know, a more intimate kind of setting and pretty much demand a kind of contemplative environment in order to actually experience the thing the way you really want to have them, people want to see it. And I think sculpture, especially this kind of larger public stuff, people come on, they come to it either on purpose or by accident, right? And because it's a physical thing, there's already a pathway into the conversation that you have with the work. You know, it's a thing, and you relate to things, and so it's a much easier in to the viewer. And then once you've got them, then you can start to explore these other ideas that the piece might have.
Bloomington Fire Chief Brian Moore says he's extremely happy with how the sculpture turned out.
It's absolutely amazing. It really is. Andrew's a very gifted artist. Of course, the face is just to be a generalized face. We're not making it specifically like someone, you know, from the department, but from the lettering on the coat, you know, the FCBA that's worn from to the flashlight that's hanging on the belt, the helmet with the shield of the BFD. It's very representative of our local, the Bloomington Fire Department, and what we provide our employees for safety and personal protective equipment.
But again, for Andrew, it's not just about the equipment, though he didn't take time to get it right. He had a full set of gear in his shop with him as he carved the clay. I asked Chief Moore what he sees in the firefighter's posture. Looks like he just arrived on the scene.
He is standing looking at the hazard that he's about to enter. And he's getting his situational awareness in order as to what he's about to embark on, right? The hazard he's about to face, that he knows what he's getting into, and that he's, you know, doing this to protect others. He just has that surreal look on his face that he knows what he's going into. He understands that it could be dangerous, but he knows the job that has to be done.
Andrew's sculpture will be featured in the new Fire Service Memorial that'll be dedicated Saturday at Miller Park. Centerpiece of that will be the refurbished bell from the fire department's original headquarters station. It's been in Miller Park for years, but without any sort of explanation about its origins. It'll change with the new memorial, which will have two branches, one for fire service and another for those who've died in the line of duty. I'm Ryan Denham.
The dedication of the new fire service memorial begins at 11 tomorrow morning, and there's a bunch of family-friendly activities, including a junior firefighter challenge and discounted admission to the Miller Park Zoo. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, and you're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a feminist drama from the late 1800s that's still relevant today. Student protests followed the school Valentine's Day mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, have not ebbed in the months since then. A Twin Cities group formed to advocate for gun reform. They'll hold a town hall tomorrow with politicians and candidates. Bloomington Normal Youth Activists is comprised of students from high school and middle school students from Bloomington Normal. Members Allie Beam, Ellie Diggins, and Gavin Cunningham stopped by the GLT studios to talk with John Norton about the event to be held at the McLean County Museum of History. Beam says though the town hall is open to the public, the format allows students to have a voice in political matters, specifically for the upcoming midterms.
Right. Students are the future. Students are our future voters, so it's really important to make sure that everyone's informed now, so in a couple years when we're voting, we know what we are voting for.
Okay. Gavin, what kind of questions are you hoping to ask and maybe get answered?
So some of the questions that we are looking to ask will involve different issues going on currently in our political atmosphere. We have certain questions about different kinds of issues such as gun control, especially of what's going on in town over the past year. But we really want people to ask questions that they care about, of things that they want to know from their representatives or the people that want to become their representatives.
How engaged are young people? Has it been the Parkland shooting that got young people engaged in politics specifically? I mean, in general, as opposed to just gun control?
That was definitely a big hand in why many young people are getting involved in politics. They see that there are a group of students down in Parkland that were able to make national headlines and start basically some sort of revolution on gun control because of what happened there. So students are realizing that we have a voice and that people will listen to us if we make that voice heard.
How many kids? Is it just like a really small number of kids in these schools that are starting to be more engaged like you guys, or has it spread a little bit wider than that?
As you probably know, we had the walkouts last year. And between Weston Community, I think we had over 500 students, as well as U-High had...
We had several hundred.
Yeah. So we have hundreds of students that are walking out on an issue that they care passionately about. And I think that that is only a small glimpse of students in our community that feel like they want to be politically active and want to make a change.
So what kind of reaction, I'll go to you, Ellie. What kind of reaction are you seeing from older people that maybe you guys are too young to be involved in this?
I was one of the main organizers for the Kingsley walkout back in March, and I actually received a lot of support from parents and some of my teachers, too. But I also received some backlash on how they felt like I was being too involved and too... like brainwashed.
Who was giving you some of that backlash? You don't have to name names. The types of, were there teachers or parents or whether online, were people giving you grief?
Mostly people online, and some of my friends' parents are giving me some backlash, but we didn't really listen to them and continue to protest.
You know, I want to go to the gun control. Anybody can address this. I was, as a parent of a now 21-year-old who went to Bloomington High School, who didn't tell me a whole lot what was going on in school, which is very typical of students, right? I had no idea all these drills were going on with shooting, you know, preparedness. When especially Parkland happened, or maybe it was before that, how scary is this for you guys? I mean, is this a very visceral thing, like on a day-to-day basis for you guys?
Absolutely. Speaking on behalf of many students in our country, I think this is an issue that we have to deal with daily because nobody at Parkland expected that it would be them. And so now we have to be aware that this is a real possibility for all of us and that we need to be able to take all the precautions necessary to ensure that this is not happening anymore.
That's Allie Bean from U-High. Also in studio is Gavin Cunningham and Ellie Diggins, both from Normal West, all three part of the group BN Youth Activists who are staging a town hall. That'll be October 12th at the McLean County Museum of History. I'm John Norton. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I want to go back to the town hall. Gavin, I'll go back to you. Is this just for students, or are you hoping the community at large is a part of this?
No, so we are hoping to get all different people from the community involved. We have registration on our website, www.bnactivist.com. Just because we do have limited seating, we have a certain amount of tickets set aside for only students, just to make sure that students who want to go get the opportunity. But we are definitely hoping and, of course, welcoming to anyone else who is wanting to go.
Who is doing the moderating?
That will be members of our group doing the moderating for this event.
Okay. And Ellie, I mean, are you looking for questions from these people who attend? And are you looking for specifically students to be asking these questions?
We're looking for people of all ages to be asking these questions. Audience members who are at the event can ask them, and we'll also be taking online questions.
Okay, I want to go back to what Ellie said about getting backlash, and it sounded like it was mostly online, and getting backlash for your activism. Ellie, why is it important for people and politicians to listen to young people who can't even vote yet?
I think it's really important to listen because the country that that is being created right now is the one that we are going to be raised in. It's the one that's going to be our future and we're going to raise our kids in. So it's really important that we are involved in it as well as everyone who is allowed to vote, because this is our future. These are our lives as well.
Gavin, I'll go back to you. You've had politicians accept they will be there answering questions. Who are some of these people?
So right now we have confirmations from Mayor Coos, Ben Webb, Jill Blair. We have a representative from the Betsy Dirksen Longdrigan campaign, as she is going to be at a different event that night. And we also have Shaina Wachinski, who is running for McLean County Board, as well as we are pretty sure about Dan Brady's attendance.
We're still waiting on his final confirmation, but we're hoping.
Okay, so there's a slight mix of Democrats and Republicans in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we're still working with other people and talking. This is in no way a final list.
Are you hoping to convert some of this town hall and what happens there into some educational efforts or lobbying efforts?
I think absolutely. Education is one of our main priorities, making sure that people are engaged in going out to the polls and voting.
When you guys started with gun control in Parkland, and now you're branching out to other ideas, what clicked in your mind about, geez, I wish I would have been paying attention to this, or maybe I wish parents or my teachers or whatever would have tried to get us more engaged earlier, or maybe they have, and it finally clicked?
Columbine happened in 1999. None of us were alive then. This has been going on our entire lives, and this is something that we've seen, we've heard in the news, but we didn't think that we could actually have an impact until we saw what happened at Parkland.
And what makes you think you're actually having an impact?
When more people are listening to us, more people are starting dialogues. We've seen that just from our own community. People are willing to talk to people that maybe don't always agree on different political issues, but see that, I mean, things like bump stocks. People are agreeing from both sides that bump stocks should just be illegal because they can turn a gun into a semi-automatic weapon.
We're talking with Gavin Cunningham from Normal Community West, Allie Bean from U-High, and Ellie Diggins, also from Normal West, Bloomington Normal Youth Activists, and they're having a town hall October 12th at the McLean County Museum of History. Is what you're doing, Bloomington Normal Youth Activists, is it considered a progressive or democratic group, or is it nonpartisan?
It is nonpartisan, and that is our goal, is to make everything as straightforward and allowing people to be able to see both sides of any issue.
So do you have more conservative members in Bloomington Normal Youth Activists right now?
Currently, we have not had a huge amount of conservative members ask to join our group, but we are certainly incredibly open and looking forward to including members, not only conservative versus liberal, but also libertarian or socialist people who want to be a part of it.
You know, and that's an interesting point. And Gavin, Ellie, I'm not ignoring you, so if you want to dive in. But Gavin, you mentioned something about 1999 when Columbine happened. You guys weren't even alive yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I certainly remember that, but I grew up in basically the 70s. And even then, you work hard and you will get somewhere out of that. You guys are in a whole different thing. I mean, socialism is not a dirty word with young people. Capitalism, it's to some people, has become a dirty word. It's like the world is flipped upside down from 30, 40 years ago. Do you still feel like I did in the early to mid-70s that I can grow up and do anything I want?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we have a lot of agency, and we feel like we can go and do a lot of different things in our world today.
But universities cost a lot more money,
that's
right?
That's true. Yeah.
Jobs, you don't just get out of school and get a $20 an hour manufacturing job. These are the kind of things I'm saying. It's like you didn't want to go to school, you're fine. You could get a job, a blue-collar job that made really good union wages.
Right, and of course it's, difficult. We have to be making these decisions, deciding what colleges are worth it for us now, considering prices or what jobs we want to do. But once we are able to decide kind of what we're interested in, it does still feel like we can still achieve.
Yeah, but I'll finish with you. I don't want to be a pessimist, but I mean, I'm going back to when I grew up and you guys are very engaged. I'm guessing you're, the bright sparks of your classes at your schools as well. Do the kids who aren't at the level you're at, do they have these same opportunities, you guys? And I'm going back to the whole conversation we had a couple years ago, why Donald Trump got elected, right? That there's all these people, we're talking older people now, that just kind of feel neglected, kind of feel like they're not a part of the American dream anymore. Do you see kids your age have that same kind of attitude?
I think that there are definitely still people that feel that way already, but I really do believe that every single person can be an important member of our society and how our government works because of the way it is set up.
Yeah, and sometimes there are factors, obviously, outside that are keeping people from being able to achieve these same types of things. But on a grand scheme, we're all trying to aid people who aren't given the same opportunities. And so maybe not at first. Maybe people aren't, everyone's not obviously on the same level from because of outside factors. But I think that with this generation, we can work, and I'm optimistic that we can help everyone to be able to achieve what they want to do.
That's Ojai senior Allie Beam, along with NCHS senior Gavin Cunningham and freshman Ellie Diggins, speaking with GLT's John Norton. The three are members of BN Youth Activists, a Twin Cities student-led organization holding a town hall for local politicians and candidates tonight at the McLean County Museum of History, beginning at 7 p.m. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It was the door slam heard round the world. When Ibsen's A Doll's House came to a close, the female protagonist walked out on her husband, her children, and the sham of a life she'd been living. For the heroine of a play to behave in such a manner was unheard of in the late 19th century. Since then, the character of Nora has been held as a standard of feminism and drama, and the play itself shows continuing relevance through the struggles of its complex characters. Heartland Theater is staging this classic. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
A woman rebels against a male-dominated society in a doll's house, freeing herself to find her full potential as an individual. Ibsen's 1879 drama shocked audiences with the choice his female protagonist makes to leave her family, slamming the door as she heads off to a new life. Heartland Theater in Normal opens A Doll's House November 1st. Actress Connie Blick is playing Nora. Reese Lovell, artistic director for Heartland Theater, directs A Doll's House. He says they're keeping it in its original late 19th century setting, although audiences of today will be struck at how contemporary the play feels.
It does speak so perfectly to what we're experiencing right now with the Me Too movement. I mean, when Ibsen wrote this play, they talk about that final moment when Nora walks away, leaves it, and you hear the door slam. It's the last piece of action, is the shutting of the door, and that in closing that door, it opened a door for women around the world, that it was a piece of feminist writing before we even knew what feminism was.
Playing this character is an opportunity to give a voice and a journey to a woman and see it through her perspective and sort of through the eyes of a lot of different characters that have almost gone on a similar journey as Nora. The way he's written these people that come into her life, especially her friend, at a certain time, it almost helps things unfold the way they do.
In its time, this play was rather shocking. At its debut, when Nora chooses to leave her husband and leave, even more shockingly, her children and close that door, people didn't applaud in the theater. They just sat there because no one had ever seen anything like this before, and they were just shocked. Is the play still shocking?
Well, it's funny, they wanted a rewrite, didn't they?
they actually got a rewrite in Germany.
Yeah, when it was done in Germany, they insisted Ibsen rewrite the ending, and rather than walking out the door, the children come out, and I think she sees the children and just collapses to the floor.
I, It depends on where you are as an audience member if you find the play shocking. I think as a mother and a dedicated mother, if I were to see that play, sure, I would maybe think, how could she do that? But on another aspect, if I followed that same journey as Nora, in certain parts of the play, there's things I can relate to and say, well, if I don't know myself and if mother isn't happy, then who is happy? You know, and then you can say, well, I can see that. I think it just depends on who you are watching, whether you find it shocking or not. And I think you may be surprised that there are a lot of aspects where you understand why she makes the decision she does at the end.
You mentioned a moment ago, Laura, that, you know, she's not just leaving Torvald, she is leaving her children. That, I think, will always be shocking, regardless of what time we're in. Certainly today in 2018, it's easy for us to accept a woman leaving her husband if it's an unhappy marriage. Nobody bats an eyelid, but to be able to walk away from your children, that's something entirely different.
She says, the children have just been my playthings like I've been to you. And so they...
Torvald, her husband.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think to her, have they just been toys? Have they just been these dolls as she's been to Torvald? And which may, in a way, make it easier for her, you know, in her eyes.
Connie, what is under the sugar-coated exterior of Nora? Is she a woman who is ready to rebel right when the curtain rises, or does that develop later on?
You mean the macaroon-coated exterior.
Husband said she couldn't have the macaroons, and she was sneaking them.
Well, I think what's funny about her is she finds the right moments to do those things. And slowly as the play progresses, she makes more choices and more of them. But she takes pride when she does go against the grain. And
so the minor rebellions maybe help to build to the big one?
Yes.
And so does that make her more relatable to us?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we all have flaws as human, you know, but I don't really know if she considers that a flaw. I think she's so different than a typical woman in that era, right? Because she's proud of that. She uses Christine to tell that secret of, I did this on my own. I have something to be proud of, too. And you,
Christine is her friend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And your ideas of me is not who I am, you know. I've done something on my own.
Prior to casting, I was talking with Connie and some other actresses who were interested in reading for the role about the two different Noras in this play. There's the Nora who we're introduced to at the very beginning, who, as we watch her interacting with Torvald, there's really some cringe-inducing moments where she's catering to his every whim and being his skylark. Yeah.
Is that my little lark twittering out there?
Yes, it is.
Is that my squirrel rummaging around?
Yes.
When did my squirrel get in?
Just now. Do join me, Torvald, and see what I've bought.
Can't be disturbed. Bought, you say? All that there? Has the little spendthrift been out throwing money around again?
Oh, but Torvald, this year we really should let ourselves go a bit. It's the first Christmas we haven't had to economize.
But you know we can't go squandering.
Yes, Torvald, we can squander a little now, can't we?
The thing is that she's wearing a mask. She's acted this role for 8 years in this marriage. She's been pretending to be the loving, dutiful wife, but she's just so unhappy.
Let's talk about the theme of the show, which is driven by the character of Nora. Is it safe to say that this is how to be true to yourself?
I do. I don't think she realizes that until the end. And I think that's why that last scene is so important. It's by what happens to those around her and how those around her react that makes her realize being true to herself is what's most important.
And, you know, it really has less to do with gender. We tend to focus just on that, the fact that that Nora happens to be a woman who's leaving a man. But it's that theme that you're talking about is really about finding the individual in yourself and asserting that.
So maybe the most radical aspect of this play is that it takes a woman's dilemma and it's actually presents it as a human dilemma. This is relevant to both sexes.
Right. Well, the line, above all, I am a human. She doesn't say, above all, I am a woman. She says, above all, I am a human being. And what's implied there is that I am afforded all of the same rights and privileges as anyone. I want to educate myself. I want to learn about the world. And I want to do it on my own terms. Mm-hmm.
The books may say one thing, and the beliefs in society may say one thing, but this is not what makes me feel comfortable. This is not what makes me me. This is not what I believe. And to take that step and that leap, you know, at that time was huge.
In any way, shape, or form, should we feel sorry for Torvald, her husband?
Yeah, I think we have to feel sympathy for all of the characters in this play, including Krogstad, who's often labeled the villain.
Because he's blackmailing Nora with some information from her past.
These are desperate people in extraordinary circumstances that are really just trying to save themselves. At the end of the day, you got to look out for number one. And so with Torvald, he is following a set of rules dictated by men, laws that were written by men. He's living according to those rules and laws. And so as far as he's concerned, he's doing everything right. So when it unravels at the end, we have to feel sorry for him because he isn't a bad man. Yeah, we may frown upon the way he patronizes her.
I sympathize with him only because he never took the time to really know her. That, as Nora, is how I sympathize. I think at the end, the positive thing is he may be taking his own journey now, and you can kind of imagine what that may be, and she helps him to do that by leaving. Yeah, it's hard to say if because he's living in the constructs of society, do you not kind of hate him for that? I mean, I don't know. Outside,
because he doesn't know any better?
Yeah, but that's not
exactly.
Yeah.
He doesn't know any better.
But just as Nora can do something outside of her constructs, then why is Torvald, can he not be that same? You know, and I think that's what makes the difference in those characters. So that's what makes Nora such an interesting character, because she does go outside of those constructs.
Connie Blick stars in A Doll's House. Rhys Lovell directs the Heartland Theater production, opening November 1st and running through the 17th. They both spoke with GLT's Laura Kennedy. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today. From Ryan Denham, Mary Cullen, and Laura Kennedy, I'm Charlie Schlenker.